This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So I thought I would start this morning by picking up on Jerome's sharing yesterday that, you know, we in our practice, we have these discoveries or whatever, and it's something that works for us, and so we share it, and that's true. And so this is, you know, my sharing with you, my experience, you know, the results of my, where I am at this point in time in my experience and practice. I remember Johnny Cash. Anybody here know Johnny Cash?
Yes.
Okay. You don't know Lucinda Williams, but you know Johnny Cash. All right. So Johnny Cash said that whenever he did a cover of somebody else's song, he had to own it. He had to make it his. And that's my sense of this practice. How do you make it yours? So mine is not going to look like yours. And you know, it struck me in the middle of the night. Well, that's what the Buddha did, right? Made it his. I mean, he carved something out. I'm not saying I'm necessarily carving anything out, but he carved something out. You know, but he built on and then carved something out. And essentially, you know, he said that I've seen how this house is built. This house, this self. I've seen how this self is built. I took it apart, and I'm not putting it back together. That's pretty radical. So this practice fundamentally encourages us to take the house apart. And not build it back. But it's done with care. You know, it's not a, and he did it with care. Wasn't, you know, haphazard job for him. He did it with care and the skill developed. And his ego fought it. The ego mind fought it. His conditioned self fought it under the Bodhi tree. I think he repressed it in his previous practice. A lot of stuff was repressed, but under the Bodhi tree, it came out. Come up here, if you would, please. Thank you. It fought it. And it's fought it. Ours fights our dismantling. It does. And I think that that's, and it's a pretty scary thing. It's like, for the ego, it's like dying. Because everything that it is, you know, created around it, it's like, oh. And the ego itself is just a thought. It's a real powerful one, a real strong one. And so that sense of taking apart the house, real scary. And I think it's important to appreciate that, and it will manifest in different ways. And it can get pretty angry at being master, in my experience. Now, I'll share some of my story this morning and how I came to this, how I've been working to make it my own. And I will say at the outset that I have tried to be as true as I can to the teachings as I know them. I've tried not to bend and warp anything out of place to make it fit. I have discussions. I have discussions with Dharma friends. What's your experience? And that's been very valuable. Yesterday I mentioned, I dedicated yesterday's talk to Renson Barbara for Kylan. And she and I, with her husband Dale, Tyson Dale. Okay. And Barbara said, she says, I realized that I've been sitting for 20 years. I didn't know what I was doing. I said, you too? And boy, did I not feel so much of an F up. Oh, thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that. So Dharma friends are for. And we touched on that subject a couple of times. And she and her husband Dale made it theirs. They wrote books, okay, and developed a teaching process and developed it their way. Barbara, she started out as a second grade school teacher, and then she became a therapist. And the style of therapy that she adopted, and bringing, I think, more and more into that. And as I was saying, she was coming into the looking into the bilateral brain. And she and Dale are really, I trust them. I trust their sense of things. Don't always agree, but I trust it. We'll do a little sidestep here into we touched on to voice yesterday, and this has something to do with it. I was reading a book, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was the foreword to the book was, Carol Gilligan was writing a foreword to one of her PhD candidate's books, and she was and it was about male voice. Now, Carol, back in the early 70s, wrote this, ground shifting book called In a Different Voice about the feminine voice. And discovered that in the earth coming as females are coming into the early adolescence, just coming in there, they're really vulnerable, losing that voice. Imagine the females in here, I'm not telling them anything new. And so this book, the book that she was writing the foreword to was about little boys. And her PhD candidate had discovered that little boys, it happens earlier, around 4 or 5. She was telling a story about this psychoanalyst who told this story, who said that when he was in kindergarten, I think it was kindergarten, they were told at the beginning of the year they're going to be learning all these songs. And then at the end of the school year, they could pick their favorite song and get up in front of the class and perform it. And so the psychoanalyst, when it came his time, he got up in front of the class and announced that his favorite song was a lullaby. And out of the corner of his eyes, he saw what his buddy's reactions. And he goes, "Oh, I was just kidding." And he broke out into the Marine Corps hymn. And he said it took him years to get his lullaby back. Just to give you an appreciation of how subtle but very powerful conditioning is. Okay. Reading the stories broke my heart because, I'm not saying anything new. I'm just telling you when it happens. But it's really powerful. And it's having, and reading that, I go, oh, yeah. I concluded, like in my late 60s, that if it hadn't been for all of that conditioning stuff, I would have been this goofy nerd and been happy with it. So I'm coming into my goofy nerdness. And but it didn't work out that way. And in my Zen practice, I've always felt like the odd one out. I'd hear these other experiences, and I would say, "Well, that's okay." Must be something wrong with me because there's. My storyline, there's always been something wrong with me. So in my Zen, there must be something wrong with me. And it took me a while, to really come into something. But the beginning to align things up, I went back in my old age, in my 50s, and I got a master's in social work and became a social worker and a therapist in my old age, just for fun and giggles, And I did this training, and I knew, I had sat in a room with an analyst for years and I had told my story of trauma as I knew it then. And then I did an EMDR training. Anybody not know what EMDR is? Judy, you want to explain
It's, can you remind me, eye movement?
it? Desensitization reprocessing.
Right. So when I had it in therapy, the therapist puts out her finger and she asks you to just follow the finger while you're thinking of a traumatic experience. And then she asks you to make it into a cartoon. This is what I remember. This is years ago. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but that was my experience. So that you're just following this finger with your eyes. And you're thinking about the traumatic experience, and then you're turning it into something funny or different in some way so that it's not so traumatizing. You know what it does, it kind of reorients how you think about everything, how you think about that particular situation. So that was my experience with EMDR.
My training was just a little different the way I was taught. Basically the same. What's happening when this is going on, your eyes are going back and forth, it's opening up a neural pathway that trauma is rooted in. Okay. And the whole thing is to rewire, to move you to you know, from this negative cognition to a positive cognition. And before you start this, there is a question. How early do you think can you remember experiencing this? And so, you know, when I was doing the training, I was doing it with a colleague, and it was my turn to experience this. It went dark. There was no memory. It was just this dark swirl of energy. I go, oh, there's something here that I didn't know about. And and it turns out years later, you know, or no, I did know about something. A conversation I had with my mother's mother given me an idea about how early it started. And then my brother and I discovered in my mother's files. And you go, you know, just it was you know, stunning. And then an aunt, my mother's sisters confirmed it all for me. It started very early, before I could walk, before there was memory. And so that really, I was damn determined at that point to delve into this. And my Zen was always a part of it. And so, you know, and so about, I don't know, in between, you know, the training, there was one training in a month, month and a half, there was another training. In between that, there was a snow day, couldn't go to work. And I was lying in bed. I found myself in a fetal position. Some idea. It was right about that time too. I was working with a couple one night, and I, you know, things were going well. I don't like doing marriage couples. You know, it's hard for me. And because I grew up around so much domestic violence, and so it, but it was going well. But I felt at one point I felt something inside move. It was weird. I felt it move, and I felt it move up, and it started. And I realized it was going to be a piece of sarcasm, because I can be. I love sarcasm, and I felt it, and I felt the energy of it. Really, it was vivid. You know, I felt the energy of it, and I knew that if it went out into the room, it wasn't going to be untoward or anything, but I knew it would change the color in the room, it changed the atmosphere in the room, but I didn't want that to happen. So I just rode the energy of it and didn't repress it, rode the energy of it, felt it come on out and dissipate, and the session went on. Teaching moment. And so that really started cueing me into the body, you know. And then I, you know, decided that, well, you know, I was, and oh, another incident, you know, after the EMDR training, I started doing mindfulness, you know, classes and stuff. And I would, you know, in these groups, I would say, when's the earliest you can remember, you know, just re-experiencing this? And I would watch these faces around the room, and they were stunned where it took them. Yeah. And so anyway, you know, time goes on. In the mindfulness teacher training, I meet a therapist who lives not far from me, and she's done years of trauma therapy. And I was starting to move into that realm, and she encouraged me to come along with her to some trauma trainings. And for the first one, we had to read this paper, and it talked about ACEs. Anybody heard of ACEs? Adverse childhood experiences. And it said in there that one thing is that about 60% of the population has experienced trauma as children. And it said what they also learned was that as they were doing intake, it was re-traumatizing. And then Peter Levine and Pat Ogden had already been on the bandwagon, or had already started this movement around somatic awareness and trauma. And so people think I talk about trauma a lot and think my focus is on trauma. That's the grounding of it, but my experience has been that it just transfers, it translates. Because in fact, you know, in the dialogue the other day, I heard a lot of trauma. And then I started, you know, in these trainings, it was all somatic. It was like, you know, where are you experiencing that right now? Does it feel, you know, what's it feel like? Can you be with it? And then you know, different models of it. And I shared one with you yesterday with the polyvagal, you know, the vagal, lateral, ventral, somatic, and dorsal, and that how that dance might look using that body awareness. And then I had these, you know, in practice, I had these experiences. One was here in 2019, and, you know, there was just this massive tsunami of conditioned response, conditioned reaction. And it wasn't fun, believe me. And I kept reminding myself, I said, this is a conditioned something. Otherwise, if I tried to fight it, I would have been swept over. And so I kept reminding myself, condition something, and turning into the body experience of it. It was like a wild ride, you know. And I, you know, I woke up about 4 o'clock in the next morning, my heart was, it was wide open. And I couldn't think that any differently. And I, you know, and I became, you know, and I, so I kept pursuing this in my reading and stuff based on my, you know, reading, training, my own experiences. And then I started doing this with clients and my meditation students. The proof was in the pudding for me. Not all of them are trauma victims, you know, but it gave me another language with which to communicate to people that's not there in normally there in our practice. And I've had to get used to these looks when I start to go there, you know, the guys over in the corner of the room, these looks, you know, I'm getting used to them. Like I said, I'm not sacrificing the voice anymore. So this is where the genus for me, making my own, came from. But it lines up, you know, it lines up with the teachings. The teachings are pretty simple and straightforward on how the human organism functions. What's coming out, you know, over the last so many decades is more and more insight into the human organism functions. It just informs this practice. It just builds on what somebody discovered 2,500 years ago. And I think it's important for this practice, Zen, Buddhism, to be able to open up, to be relevant to in people's lives. Because it's healing. This practice is healing. You know, we chant sutras, we study sutras, and then we sit meditation. But I think expanding our awareness of what's going on in us as human organisms, as animals, is important in informing our practice. So, you know, it just opens things up for us. And very fundamentally, it's just, you know, what it's just continues what the Buddha discovered, is that there are five aggregates, and that's it. That was his focus. The five aggregates: form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. And what the human organism, what happens with the human organism, the worlds we create in our minds and believe it's real. Based on our conditioning. So your worlds are going to be maybe a lot different than mine. Maybe not. We share some things. We share our discriminations. We share our, you know, patterns of racism. All of that, classism, whatever, you know, there's that. But it's also, you know, we also have our histories of, as Miller Williams said, what's down there close to the bone. And it, you know, and so how it informs us in our relationship to ourself. You know, it helped me to be less judging of myself. And believe me, that was a powerful, powerful energy. It was a hammering energy. And as that eased up, you know, my relationship to others began to change. And it's, the ego is scared at times, yeah. Tearing apart the house, tearing it down. So the question of, you know, how do we exist when we tear the house down? What guidelines do we have to go by? And Dogen was continually telling us no guidelines. But how do we function? He also said, how do we function? He was always challenging our fixed views. This practice challenges our fixed views, our fixed habit patterns. It challenges our house. It started way before we were born. And so insight. Okay. And I continually say to my clients, you know, who come in, you know, I says, well, okay, we can do, you know, but you ain't gonna think a lot of this to happen. Because using the framework, the blueprint that built the house in the first place, to try, you know, the thinking behind it to try to take it down, is not going to work. What insisted on putting it up, it's not going to work. But we need that. We need that too. As Joe Volpe Taylor discovered, you know, we need that too. We need that ego dynamic. We need that idea of an ego. But how loosely can then we begin to dance with it? I think that's fun. I think that's a fun exploration. I'll just share this just in closing from Reverse Meditation by Andrew Bolichek. Prapancha, I think that's how you say it, is proliferation. In the contracted non-meditative mind, that same, it talks about the spark. There could be a spark of an idea that just, you know, happens harmlessly. But then there's a spark that happens that to go, just like putting a match to gasoline, it goes whoosh. Prapancha is an aspect of the egoic mind because ego itself is just a contracted storyline. Ego lives on conceptual proliferation, authoring its very existence through prapancha. By working with conceptual proliferation in meditation, you can release egoic contraction from your life, one storyline at a time, one board at a time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.